Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
Lectures were great podcasts. why the popular lecturers insisted that everyone be admitted or they would not lecture there. And so because of that, he heard these two lecturers, Ralph Waldo Emerson and the Reverend Theodore Parker, both Unitarians. And he had agreed to William Lloyd Garrison's abolitionist newspaper, The Liberator, since arriving in New Bedford. In 1841, he attended a meeting of the American Anti-Slavery Society in order to hear Garrison speak in person. He thought of Garrison as a prophet in the biblical tradition. And he was recognized and asked to take the stage and speak of his experience as a slave. The evangelical Christian abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison quickly recognized Douglas's gifts and asked him to join the society as a paid agent who would give speeches on his life in slavery. His first speaking engagement was at the church in West Roxbury, Massachusetts, where the minister was Theodore Parker. As one biographer put it, Douglas eventually had to make a choice between abolitionism and Christianity, or at least between abolitionism and the church. Garrison himself broke with the churches over the unwillingness of many of the ministers to support abolition. The Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 and the Dred Scott decision of 1857 undercut Douglas's own belief that God would bring an end to slavery. And he chose abolitionism and human action as the path to the end of slavery. Yet for what became strident criticisms of both black and white churches, he was, like many others, raised in or converted to Christianity and was discouraged not by the teachings of Jesus, which he continued to admire, but the inability of those who preached in Jesus' name to live in accordance with those teachings. In 1845, he wrote an autobiography, and in the appendix said, "I find since reading over the foregoing narrative that I have in several instances spoken in such a tone and manner respecting religion as may possibly leave those unacquainted with my religious views to suppose me an opponent of all religion. What I have said respecting and against religion, I mean strictly to apply to the slaveholding religion of this land, and with no possible reference to Christianity proper. For between the Christianity of this land and the Christianity of Christ, I recognize the widest possible difference. So wide that to receive one as good, pure, and holy is of necessity to reject the other as bad, corrupt, and wicked. I love the pure, peaceable, and impartial Christianity of Christ. I therefore hate the corrupt, slave-holding, women-whipping, cradle-plundering, partial, and hypocritical Christianity. He had written his first autobiography. He would eventually write three, in order to assert who he was and his authority to speak on slavery. And even before the passage of the Fugitive Slave Act, he had been subject to return to the South in his book on behalf of abolition. So hence he had changed his name from Bailey to Douglas. But also, he left out details of where he was a slave and who his owners were, in order to keep them off of his trail. This lack of detail, plus great oratorical gifts, made even relatively liberal Northerners suspect that he hadn't really been a slave because he didn't think slaves could learn to read and write and speak that well. Yes, there was racism even amongst the abolitionists. Abolitionists encouraged him, in fact, to speak more like a slave and less like the educated person he had become. But instead, he wrote that first autobiography, The Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, an American Slave, published in 1845. Because he was still legally a slave, he then went to England for 2 years to avoid capture and return to the South, and considered settling there permanently. But he missed America, and instead of sending for his wife and children, he returned to the United States. But he became legally free because a group of English friends raised the money to buy his freedom from the Auls. He said they were just paying a ransom. So after his return to the States in 47 and now legally free, he went on a lecture tour. Later that year, he began his own weekly paper, North Star, and settled in Rochester, New York. He chose Rochester for several reasons. First, having previously been based in New Bedford and later Lynn, Massachusetts, both ports, he decided not to publish in the same region as Garrison published The Liberator, to which he contributed articles and subscribed. Rochester is also a center of both abolitionist and women's rights activity, and he had already been inclined to link the two issues. He attended the first women's rights convention in 1848 and began lifelong friendships with Susan B. Anthony, Lucretia Mott, and other leading advocates of women's rights. Also, Rochester was close to the Canadian border, and his home, like several others in that city, became the station on the Underground Railroad. And increasingly, he saw political action to be essential to abolition, as essential as moral suasion, which was Garrison's preferred strategy. And in 1851, they broke over this disagreement of strategy. And then on July 5th, 1852, in Rochester, he delivered that speech, "What to the Slave is the 4th of July?" In short, it was a mockery to the slave, a mockery of the principles that the founding fathers claimed in principles of freedom and democracy. He castigates the religious and civic hypocrisy of the nation, but also affirms the hope that it will end slavery and live up to its founding ideals. And he also goes into his ideas about religion and church-state separation in much more depth than he did in the autobiography. Like I said, it probably took him an hour and a half to deliver it, at least. But people listened to those speeches in those days. A typical church sermon was an hour. And people often heard two a day, morning and evening on Sundays. So to go to the Lyceum and hear an hour and a half lecture a brilliant orator, it was not only a learning experience, but some of the best entertainment around. When the Civil War broke out, Douglas was disappointed that President Lincoln asserted the priority of maintaining the Union over the freedom of the slaves. Yet he encouraged free blacks to enlist in the Union Army and met with Lincoln in 1863 to protest the unequal treatment given to black and white soldiers. Two of Douglas's sons served in the Union Army. A year later, in 1864, he and Lincoln met to develop a plan to lead the blacks north to freedom in the event of a Union military defeat. He attended Lincoln's second inauguration, and when guards tried to keep him from entering the reception, the president ordered that he be admitted and make a point of the guests seeing him and Douglas speaking together. After the Civil War, Douglas continued to advocate for full civil rights for black men and with the women's movement for the vote for women. There was a split in the women's suffrage movement over whether to support the vote for black men before insisting that it be given to all women. And it was a very serious split in the women's suffrage movement. Douglas pushed for black male enfranchisement first and then women's suffrage. The 15th Amendment to the Constitution that gave the vote to black men was adopted and ratified in 1870. The 19th Amendment, which enfranchised women, was not adopted for another 50 years until 1920. Nonetheless, Douglas worked tirelessly for women's suffrage, literally until the day he died, where he died just hours after sharing a platform with Susan B. Anthony at a women's rights gathering in 1895. I mentioned that he had published a paper on the North Star, which later renamed Frederick Douglass's paper. He closed that down upon the ratification of the 15th Amendment and became the editor of a paper called The New National Era. 70s, he moved his family to Washington, D.C., to be the closer, to be closer to the center of political activity. And there he held several government posts to which he was appointed by Republican presidents. He was a popular lecturer, not just on abolition on civil rights, but on topics which he studied, science, folklore. He even gave a lecture on Scandinavian folklore that was well received. And although he had never attended school, literally, he had never spent a day in a classroom, he had become a learned man through his own reading and travel and listening to and speaking with others. His wife Anna died in 1882, and a year later he married a white woman who was 20 years younger than he was, Helen Pitts. Now he was criticized for this by both fellow blacks and by whites who supported black voting rights. He stated that he himself was the child of a black mother and a white father. He had every reason to believe that his slave owner was his father. And that his parents had not been married, so his legal marriage to a white woman seemed to him rather moral than rather than immoral act. Time and again in Douglass's life, his independent thinking and actions brought him to conflict with allies. From his strategies for abolition to priorities in widening the vote, and even to matters of religion. At a celebration of the 15th Amendment in Philadelphia in 1870, Douglass gave a speech, from which I read the excerpts earlier, that led a group of distinguished black ministers asking him publicly to keep silent. After hearing the preachers thank God for the vote, he got up and asserted that it was human action, not divine action, that had won freedom from slavery and the right to vote. "I dwell here," he said, "in no hackneyed cant about thanking God for this deliverance. My thanks tonight are to willing hearts and willing hands that labored in the beginning amid loss of reputation and amid insult and martyrdom and at imminent peril of life and limb." During the struggle, he went on to say, laymen and preachers were, quote, always holding us back by telling us that God would abolish slavery in his own good time. At the same time, he spoke out against the current effort to have the Bible used in public schools. Now, Bible readings were not new to public schools in those times, but it became a dispute as the Catholic population in the cities grew. And there was an argument about whether it be the King James Bible or the Dewey Bible, the Catholic version. And Douglass came down on the side of just not teaching the Bible in public schools, because that's not what the public schools were for. That's what church schools were for. That's when he said, "My command to the church and all denominations of the church, whether Catholic or Protestant, is hands off the government. My command to the government is hands off the church." So this really upset a group of the leading black ministers at Philadelphia, and they held a meeting at the Philadelphia Colored Methodist Church where they resolved, quote, "that we will not acknowledge any man as a leader of our people who will not thank God for the deliverance and enfranchisement of our race, and will not vote to retain the Bible, the Book of God, in our public schools." Douglass responded with a letter to the Philadelphia Press. Quote, "I would not stultify myself. During 40 years of moral effort to overthrow slavery in this country, this system with all its hell black horrors and crimes found no more secure shelter anywhere than in the religious cant of the day. Our one honest abolitionist was a greater terror to slaveholders than whole acres of camp meeting preachers shouting loyalty to God." Now, Douglass made no claims of being a preacher, though he had been one in his younger years, but had given it up. And he made no claims to being a theologian, but he was knowledgeable of the Bible and thought deeply on religious matters. And he now entered into a debate that is common in American religion: divine agency versus human agency. Did God free the slaves and win the vote? Or did the men and women who struggled for justice? only through such men and women that I can get a glimpse of God anywhere. Well, over his lifetime, Frederick Bailey became Frederick Douglass and traveled the path first from slave to freeman. He recounted this journey in 3 autobiographies and numerous lectures. He also traveled the path from evangelical Christian to liberal Christian, and in the thought of some historians, maybe even to religious humanism. As a young abolitionist, he spoke of God's will for freedom and of the necessity of divine intervention to, in his words, cleanse the land. By 1848, however, he was willing to say that humanity shared the responsibility for ending slavery. By 1853, he was criticizing the widely popular preacher Henry Ward Beecher for preaching reliance upon God to end slavery. In his essay titled Frederick Douglass, Maryland Slave to Religious Liberal, the historian William Vandenberg suggests that the transcendentalists and Unitarians who were abolitionists and allies in the struggle influenced his thought. And he certainly had a great deal of interaction with them from his early years in the North. There is evidence of friendship and admiration, but none of the liberal church affiliation on Douglass's part. Over the years, he moved from the language of faith to the language of reason. He even described his opinions as liberal in an 1870 letter to a friend. I have no doubt that the avowal of my liberal opinions will drive many from me who were once my friends, and even exclude me from many platforms upon which I was a welcome speaker. But such is the penalty which every man must suffer who admits a new truth into his mind. I am sensitive to the good opinions of men and shall suffer, but I am in a measure prepared for whatever may come to me in this respect. As to my not going far enough, I have to say that while I am free to follow my convictions wherever they may lead, I deem it wise to avow those which are perfectly formed, clearly defined, and about which I am entirely undisturbed by doubts of any sort. I vow to no priests either of faith or unfaith. I claim as against all sorts of people simply perfect freedom of thought. Now, from a man who individually and as a leader had fought slavery and won, who had supported reform beyond the interests of his own people, who had crossed race lines to marry, how could we expect any less independence and courage in the matter of religion? As he declared in his response to the black ministers of Philadelphia, who had been shocked by his insistence